Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you with us today as we begin our program by taking a look at how radio changed American culture. I don't know about you, but my most prized possession as a teenager, and I got this for my 13th birthday, was a portable, battery-operated Silvertone radio. And it had a little handle on that, on the radio, and I carried that radio with me. I hung it over the handlebars of my bike. I listened to music at night. I'd listen to the Milwaukee Braves, not the Milwaukee Brewers, the Milwaukee Braves, and I'd listen to Papa Hambone and Jack Buechler and Buechler's Beat and a lot of the great fun announcers, and sort of lived radio. And part of that is described, or a lot of it's described in the book, Something in the Air. In fact, our guest today, Mark Fisher, he's an award-winning journalist, by the way, columnist for the Washington Post, won many journalism awards, including the Associated Press Award for Best Column Writing in 2001. And he's the author of the book, Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. And he talks about how radio shaped our political, our social, and our cultural landscape. And I really had a lot of fun reading it. And he talks about a lot of the good things and some of the really gets into some of the problems associated with radio and today's radio, both commercial radio and public radio, I might add as well. I was particularly, since I've been on a public radio for many, many a year now, I was particularly interested in what he had to say about it as well. So we're going to visit with him about how radio shaped us and where it is now and where it's going and what's its future. And I'm looking forward to the visit, and I hope you are too. And certainly if you want to join in when we visit with Mark Fisher, please feel free at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Mark Fisher, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's great to be with you, Larry.
You and I had sort of similar kinds of early years because you listened to radio a lot, I think, the way I listened to it.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, a lot of people who grew up in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s had that experience of taking that transistor radio and tucking it under the pillow late at night so that your parents couldn't know that you were still awake. And it was kind of a bit of privacy in a childhood that maybe didn't have a whole lot of privacy. And it was a chance to break away from your parents' taste, whatever that might have been, and discover a world on your own, make something your own. And that is what transistor radios made possible. You know, we live in this age right now where the iPod and digital downloading have revolutionized radio and music and allowed people to create their own radio stations. But I would argue that the advent of the transistor radio was a much more liberating and innovative moment. It was that moment that the radio, that mass media and pop culture moved out of the living room, away from the parents' control, into each person's hand, and it gave a new kind of power and authority to young people who, for the first time, were able to mold their own popular culture experience.
Yeah, and radio was a lot different then, wasn't it, in terms of its programming?
It sure was. When I started out to write Something in the Air, the thing I was trying to get out, I thought originally I would write about the rise and fall of Top 40 radio and how it created this sense of a generation, a group of people who were defined by their age. But what I realized when I got into it was that if you look at the period of radio history from 1950 to the present, in other words, starting with that moment when TV burst onto the scene and changed everything in American life, from how we spent our evenings to who we hung out with, to the way we communicate with our family, at that moment, radio was given up for dead. And the more I did the research, the more I realized that that moment was remarkably like what we are living through today, where all the old media are given up for dead. Everyone thinks, oh, books and newspapers and radio and television are sinking because of this internet juggernaut. It was exactly the same kind of talk and rhetoric in the early 1950s when everyone assumed that radio was dead because of television.
And it's not dead, and it's not going to be dead, I don't think.
You know, I think you're right, and I think the lesson that I learned in researching that period and going out and reporting and talking to the people who made radio what it was and made it adapt and change after TV came along is that old media don't really die. They tend to adapt. They evolve. They reach a new audience. They define their audience in a new way, and radio kind of stumbled into this. You know, the innovation didn't come from the big networks and the executives in New York or in L.A. The innovation came from panicky and desperate radio station owners in small towns, mainly in the Midwest, who were far enough away from New York and that power structure there that they felt the freedom to break some taboos. And foremost among those was the taboo that you don't play records on the radio. That was the rule through the 1940s. And, I mean, it was such a rule that the Musicians Union called a strike, and for a couple of years there during World War II, no recordings were produced because the musicians wanted to drive home the point that you will not play records on the radio. Instead, of course, radio stations and networks had their own orchestras and bands and so on.
And wasn't it, I'm trying to think now, Todd Storrs, was it?
Yes, Todd Storrs in Omaha, Nebraska. This is the son of the local brewer, the big beer guy in town, and daddy bought his boy a radio station as a present. I know it happens to all of us. But there he was, this young guy owning a radio station, and basically in those days in the 1940s, all he had to do was press the on button because the programming all came in from the network in New York, and NBC and CBS provided all the sitcoms, the variety shows, all the comedies, the staples that of programming that we now associate with television, they were all on the radio. Well, 1950, 51, right around the moment when most American cities got television for the first time, all that programming, all those stars, all the Milton Berles and Lucille Balls and Gunsmoke and so on, all walked right out the door of the radio studio, right across the hall to the TV side, and the networks took their eye off radio for quite some time thereafter, and that left radio station owners like Todd Storrs in Omaha, Nebraska, not knowing what to do. Well, what am I going to do with this radio station? What am I going to put on the air? And so he was desperate enough that he broke the taboo against playing records on the radio, and he broke a second taboo. In those days, it was considered the absolute rule that you don't play the same song on the radio more than once a month. Now, this seems utterly bizarre by today's standards, but it took somebody like Todd Storrs in his desperation to say, we're going to break both those rules. And the reason he did it is that he had one of those great light bulb moments where he was out at a diner in Omaha that he used to hang out in late at night. He had his eye on a particular waitress. He'd hang out there until she was done closing down the shop, cleaning up, and he noticed that all the waitresses would plunk their nickels into the jukebox to hear the same songs over and over again. And this flew in the face of the gospel truth in the radio industry, but he thought it made sense. People want to hear their favorite songs. If you could figure out what people's favorite songs were, you could get a successful radio format out of that, which is exactly what he did, and was the birth of Top 40 Radio.
And it was interesting, and I hadn't even considered this or thought about it, but Top 40 Radio, why the 40, why not 50 or 30, and you have an answer for that.
Yes, in fact, it's so simple that we don't even think about it. 40 just happened to be approximately the number of records you could play during a DJ's average three-hour shift on the radio. So the idea was during this guy's show, he'd play the top 40 records because those were the number of songs he could fit into his air shift.
Yeah, it's a great story. And Storrs, somebody else probably would have thought of it if he hadn't eventually, but give him the credit, that's for sure. And he made some money on that, became a very popular way to broadcast, obviously. And there were many kind of great personalities that developed on the air during that time.
There were, and Todd Storrs really fomented that because he created the idea that these radio stations ought to be driven by personality. He created the idea that the DJs would be people who kind of accompanied you along your day. This was a whole new idea in the media, in pop culture, because previous to this, in the so-called golden age of radio, there were shows much like we have on television today, where you know you watch a comedy, and then there might be a crime show, and then there might be a variety show. And radio stations didn't have a single personality the way they do now. Well, Todd Storrs changed that. He said, you know, the station is more or less going to sound the same over the course of a day. What's going to make it worth listening to is that not only do we play your favorite songs, but anybody could do that. Anybody could play the same records. What's going to make us distinctive is the DJs, not only in their choice of records, but more so in their personality, the way they connect with people, the way they know their communities intimately. This was the period when radio stations started to sound like the communities that they were in. So you had DJs who knew what the high school football team was up to, where the traffic jam might be. They knew some stuff about the local politicians and the stores and restaurants that were good to go and check out. And that kind of intimacy, that kind of connection to where people lived was something new in the 1950s, and sadly it's something that we've lost 50 years later.
Yeah, and I certainly want to talk about that, but just to take it a little further, you know, back when I was a kid, was AM radio. And I think FM radio kind of changed the formats, as you talk about in your book.
It did. FM was a whole new frontier beginning in the late 1960s. FM had been around since the late 40s, but it was really a highbrow sort of thing. It was mainly something that people had who had some of those early high fidelity systems with very good sound and who were very concerned about hearing the best classical music or the Broadway show tunes on FM radio. Most people didn't have FM radios until the late 60s. They weren't standard equipment in cars until the early 1970s. So that was the moment, really, the late 60s, early 70s, when FM opened up, and this was an enormous revolution in popular culture for two reasons. First of all, it allowed a whole new generation of talent and creativity to come into radio with a bunch of new ideas. It opened up all these new frequencies so you could start with different kinds of formats. And that's the second big innovation that we got with FM radio, this idea that you didn't have to have just one top 40 radio station that played all different genres of music, no matter as long as they were just popular songs. You know, in top 40, we all developed a certain kind of patience, because if we hated the hard rock song that came along one moment, all we had to do was wait 3 minutes and maybe a softer kind of song would come along that we liked. And we were willing to wait for that because we didn't have a whole lot of choice. Along came FM, and suddenly we had a whole lot of choices, and that allowed radio executives to say, you know what, you don't have to wait anymore. We're going to make you a new kind of promise, which is we're going to provide you with your favorite music, and we're going to define that demographically according to how old you are, where you live, what your ethnic background is, and these niches got smaller and smaller and narrower until the broadcasters were able to promise advertisers, hey, we can deliver a specific age group, and your advertising money comes to us because you're trying to reach that age group. And that became what defined the content on the radio rather than any idea about what people might enjoy listening to.
Mm. Mark Fisher, our guest today, author of Something in the Air, Radio Rock and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. It's published by Random House. Give us a call if you have a question for him at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Mark Fisher today about his book, Something in the Air, published by Random House. Glad to have you listening in. Again, if you want to join us, the number 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's give our listeners a chance to join in here, Mark. Stephanie in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for the show, and thank you, Mark, for writing that book. I heard you on Talk the Nation. And is the book on CD yet? Is it just in the hardcover book form?
It's just in book form right now. We're still hoping that we'll get a book on tape or CD version of it out, so stand by for that. There's also, if you want to hear some of the people, some of the great voices who are described in the book, you can go to my website at markfisher.com, and there are audio clips where you can listen to some of these really revolutionary characters on the radio from the 50s all the way up to the present.
Well, I tell you, you're a man after my own heart, because I'm actually married to a guy who has he's a part-time DJ. He just retired from the post office, but he's on a community radio station in Madison, and he plays the real oldies. People tell him he's a real, like, almost like hearing a throwback to the DJs of the 50s and 60s. And I grew up in a small town, 60 miles south of Madison. I've lived in Madison for pretty much all my life, and Madison had a local top 40 station, which when I was here as a kid, I got to listen to, but I loved WLS from Chicago.
Sure.
People in our age group, remembering top 40 radio, there was electricity, a mystique, a romance about it, especially with WLS. I mean, I loved that station and had the transistor radio, and it could come in at night, and sometimes later, in the afternoon during the weekends, I could get it. But and I actually got to meet one of the DJs. They initially started out in I think it was May of 1960. They went to Top 40, and there is a group called the Magnificent Seven. Most of them are gone now, but I got to meet one of the guys, Bob Hale, who was the MC. For the concert that Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper played at Clear Lake, Iowa in 1959. That was where, the plane mm-hmm. crashed. But, it was just wonderful.
I'm
going to hang up and let you guys talk, okay? I could talk forever.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. You know, everywhere I go talking about this book, people want to tell me their radio stories. They want to talk about the DJs they grew up with, the ones who accompanied them while they did their homework at night, the ones who kind of talked them through whatever adolescent love crisis they went through. And when I talk to college kids and young people about this, they're kind of mystified by this emotional connection that people mm-hmm. Who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s, that those folks had with DJs on AM Top 40 radio. Because kids growing up today just don't have that connection. The DJs seem almost like automatons. But in that earlier period, the DJs connected with people in an emotional way. They felt like and they knew the communities that they served. They were present at the high schools. They went to the record hops. They led the dances. And so they were people who you could connect with. That is something that radio lost as it became more corporate, more nationally syndicated, bigger media companies owning thousands of stations across the country, lost that local connection, and that's why a whole generation of listeners has turned away from radio and has turned to the Internet primarily for getting new music.
It is interesting because I teach courses here on the UW-Madison campus, and the students, and in their communications classes, and I teach a broadcast class. By the way, I think I'm going to use your book as a reference book for that class.
Thank you.
Students to read, because I think it's certainly well worth reading. But the whole issue of why, you go through why students no longer listen, the young people no longer tune in as ardently, and as you say, have no idea why anybody would be so enamored with radio. And that talk a little more about that.
Well, I think what's happened in the last 20 years, two things. For radio went in one direction, while the whole popular culture went in another. The technology was making it easier for people to create their own radio stations, follow their own interests. And so we have this generation that's grown up knowing and believing that if you have an interest in, say, Latvian folk songs, you can go on the Internet and find the other 12 people who share your interest, no matter how narrow it is, and you can create a community around that. Whereas radio spent the whole same period going in exactly the opposite direction, away from all the interesting genres of music that people are passionate about, and trying to create something much broader and much blander. And so as radio became much more homogenized, the satellite technology made it possible for the same programming to air coast to coast, whether it's in talk shows or DJ music shows. And so you didn't have the local connection and the local talent that you once had. And that was another way in which radio lost its way. You know, right now we're at this moment where radio has a way to get back into the game. You may have heard all these promotional announcements on the radio about HD radio, which is essentially digital radio, so that Wisconsin Public Radio can offer not just a couple of streams of programming, but several. And so that when you tune to one frequency on the dial, there'll be an option to listen to two or three different streams of programming on that same frequency. The digital technology allows a station to do that. Well, that opens up a whole new environment for radio. They haven't really taken advantage of it yet for the most part, and of course most people don't have those radios yet. But if that technology catches on, it'll give broadcast radio, good old-fashioned free broadcast radio, a chance to maybe catch up with satellite radio that you have to pay for, or internet radio that where the choices seem infinite.
Yeah. Arlene in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Arlene. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I just had a couple of comments. I grew up in the 40s with radio. I remember my dad, however, using a crystal set to try to get Fargo news out of Fargo, North Dakota. But I'm sure we must have had a radio also at that time, right, in the 40s?
Sure.
But, you know, one of the problems growing up with radio was the trying to learn to recognize sounds, you know, because we were so non-visual. If you lived out in the boonies and didn't go many places, you didn't recognize applause and all kinds of things. I remember were a learning experience. My dad kept notes about things like that, and we just can't imagine now living that way and learning that way. But I wanted to make a comment that you made on what you said early when you were talking about that guy that got a radio station for his birthday.
Yeah.
And you said that all the programming came out of, I don't know, New York, and all you had to do was press a button. Well, you know, you didn't press buttons in those days. You turned knobs.
That's true. That's absolutely true. The technology has certainly changed, even from as late as the 1980s, when people were still turning dials and knobs in radio stations. And today, everything is digitized, and a lot of people, when you watch people do radio these days, a lot of it is just touching the screen on a computer display terminal.
Thanks, Arlene, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Gladys in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi to you. Hello.
I have a little story that I think would be kind of interesting. Way back in the way back years, we were the first family in the community to have a radio. It was an Atwater Kent with a horn. And I can't recall if it had two batteries or four batteries that was run out of it, and an antenna, a line that ran out to a pole. And we got it on a Friday afternoon. I believe it was on a Friday afternoon. And, of course, we told the neighbors that we were getting a radio. So Saturday night was the barn dance. There was only standing room in our living room. It's a memory I will never forget.
Yeah, you know, it's that kind of community that you're talking about is something that is, really shoots right through the central vein of this book, because as we look at the period from 1950 to the present, radio really brought people together in new and unusual ways through that whole time. And, you know, going back to that early radio period in the 20s and 30s, where people would gather around in the living room, radio was bringing families together for the kinds of experiences that people later associated with TV. Well, jump forward to the 50s and 60s, and people are starting to divide up into more of an individual experience with radio, especially when the car radio comes along and becomes really big, and the transistor radio in the 50s. And that allowed folks to have privacy with the radio. That's what paved the way for some of the raunchier stuff that came along in the 80s and 90s with raunchy talk radio, because as commutes got longer and people spent more and more private time in the car, that kind of you know, and as the public conversation became maybe a little more stilted and we were a little more cautious about what we said about each other, in the car you could listen to people like Howard Stern who were saying all sorts of things that you're not allowed to say in public. And that privacy of the car was a tremendous change for radio and the role that it played. But I think, you know, radio uniquely brings people together. One of the major characters in the book is a guy named Gene Shepard, who was a New York-based talk show host, but not in the model of talk show that we're used to today. He was really more of a storyteller. And most people know Gene Shepard as the guy who's the narrator of the movie A Christmas Story that airs on cable TV every December.
He's a great writer, too.
Terrific writer, and what he was really best at was he spent every night on the radio for more than 30 years, and during that time he developed this wonderful cast of characters, and he created around his nighttime radio show an audience that he called, that he would address as a unit. He would call them the night people, and he would invite them to do things together. There's that great scene in the movie Network where the TV news guy summons everyone to go to their windows, throw open their windows, and shout out into the city, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." That is stolen directly from what Gene Shepard really did on the radio, where he would have his listeners go to the window and shout out "Excelsior," which was his sort of pet slogan. And it was a way for people to realize that even in the middle of the night, in all their loneliness, through the radio, there were other people out there who were sharing that experience with them, and that they were somehow a community, even though they would never meet each other.
Yeah. Do you think that's captured in the stories that we hear from Lake Wobegon?
Yes, very much so. And actually, Garrison Keillor told me that a lot of his inspiration came from Gene Shepard and from those kinds of things that Shepard did. This guy Shepard is not very famous, but the more I talk to radio people, whether it was Garrison Keillor or Robert Siegel or from NPR or even some of the raunch radio folks and some of the wild and crazy morning zoo DJs, a lot of them traced their lineage back to Gene Shepard and what he discovered in the 1950s and 60s, which was a way of making radio into a much more personal and intimate medium. Television and the movies are much more collaborative. It takes hundreds of people to make a great movie or a great TV show. But one person on the radio can still connect with people in a one-on-one communication that is unique to that medium.
It absolutely is. Thanks again, Gladys, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Greg in Waukesha, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good.
Good. Great. I've been interested in radio since childhood, and I am finally studying it in college. I'm majoring in mass communications, and I have my own radio show. And what I'm wondering, and you may have just answered my question a little bit, but I really want to be one of those radio people that really connect, you know, with the audience. And it seems like we're trained as, even in my training, we started out just as announcers, music announcers. You know, you can only announce what song is playing and what song is coming up next. And that's how they trained us firsthand. But I really want to be, I listened to some of those 80s radio people that you were talking, even like Casey Kasem and
sure.
even some of the, I go to some different websites to listen to radio clips from the 80s personalities. I really want to be that charismatic, that connecting, because I really enjoy, you know, even get the kind of a sort of hammed up radio name, you know, and, you know, like some of those guys, like The Real Deal or, you know, some of those. What do you think, how can we, as, I mean, there's got to be a way that, you know, we can better connect with our audience, and as radio students, how can we do that?
Well, I'm glad that's your desire and that's your direction, and I only fear that you're being trained to put off audiences. You know, you're trained to be kind of a radio automaton, just delivering the names of the songs and the time and the temperature and the weather. Because that, unfortunately, is the direction that too much of commercial radio has moved in over the last 15 to 20 years, where because companies, a handful of companies, bought up thousands of radio stations across the country, they amounted enormous debt, and they had to cut costs to pay that debt. So they became very cautious and very conservative about what they wanted on their radio stations. They wanted a certain sameness to the stations all across the country. And we lost that uniqueness. We lost that individual talent, that sense of one person, one personality getting through to us on the radio. So I'm thrilled that you have that instinct, and I encourage you to charge ahead with it because your timing is really excellent. This is a moment where the radio industry is becoming quite panicky and desperate. It really reminds me very much of the early 1950s when TV came along and radio, in its desperation, cultivated a whole new generation of creative voices. I think radio, corporate radio, is getting ready to do that. They're feeling the pain as they've lost a generation of listeners to the internet and to iPods. So if you can develop a great talent and a new way of telling stories and introducing music and showing people your personality on the radio, this is the moment to present that, because I think the executives at radio companies are open to a new kind of talent for the first time in a long while.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. What about talk radio? Talk about talk radio a little bit.
Sure. Talk radio really is a creation, oddly enough, of the federal government, because it was only after the feds lifted the regulations on talk. They lifted the Fairness Doctrine in the late 1970s. The Fairness Doctrine was the rule that said if I go on the air and say Joe Blow is a terrific guy, I had to let you come on and say, no, Joe Blow is an awful guy.
Yep.
Well, and that kind of very rigorous government-mandated balance really made talk radio something that radio executives didn't want to deal with. It was just too cumbersome and too difficult. It wasn't worth their time. They didn't think it would reach an audience in any appealing way. Well, after that was lifted, you had this interesting moment where talk radio began to blossom in local markets. People like Bob Grant in New York City and a guy named Rush Limbaugh out in Sacramento, California, came along, and he realized that he could take the mechanics of Top 40 radio. He was an old Top 40 DJ. In fact, if you go on my website, you can hear him in his old Top 40 incarnation when he was known as Jeff Christie. He had modeled himself, you know, the caller earlier about WLS in Chicago, Limbaugh had modeled himself after the legendary WLS DJ Larry Lujack. And what Limbaugh realized was that you could take the pace and the feel of Top 40 radio with jingles and with really fast-paced language and simply replace the phone calls for the song and make it a political talk show, and make it very hot, make it very, a lot of ranting and a lot of strong opinion expressed very strongly. And that was a great revelation. That revolutionized talk radio and allowed it to become a mass appeal kind of format. And, of course, the rest is history. Talk radio has evolved. That generation that came up in the 80s listening to Limbaugh and his many imitators is aging out of the prime group that advertisers want to reach. And so the next wave of innovation was what's generally known as FM talk. These are the raunchy Howard Stern kinds of shows that spent the 90s sort of pushing the envelope to see what kinds of sex and other references they could get away with on the air.
And Howard Stern has gone off the air and got, well, in a way, at least off commercial radio, and is now on XM.
Exactly, and satellite radio still kind of in its infancy, but both XM and Sirius now wanting to merge, because what they've found is that they took something that's very simple and generally inexpensive, radio, and they turned it into something very expensive, because they went after a lot of big celebrities and showered them with money, and so satellite radio got off to a very big start. It was one of the fastest growing new technologies in American history. But now they're having trouble reaching a lot more people and paying all their bills, so they want to merge those two companies together. I think in the long run, satellite radio is going to look like an interim technology, because we're just a few years away now from a point where we'll probably have internet, wireless internet in the car. And when that happens, you'll have access to an infinite number of internet radio stations that you won't have to pay for, and that'll do some damage to the business model behind satellite radio, which requires a monthly subscription fee. So satellite radio now is trying to kind of rejigger itself, recast itself as a content provider that will provide you with interesting audio programming in all kinds of different places, whether it's in an airplane, in your car, at restaurants. They're trying to expand the ways in which you get their programming, not just on a satellite radio.
And what's your take on commercial radio, or public radio then for that matter, in terms of local programming? You'd probably argue that we don't have very much local programming anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, you guys at the Ideas Network are really kind of an exception. In much of the country, public radio has become almost exclusively the news and talk programming provided by NPR out of Washington. And while that programming is excellent, and there's no news organization on the radio with remotely the same resources and quality as NPR News, what that's done is, in most places in the country, it has eliminated a lot of the programming that was the original justification for public radio. So when public radio was created in the early 1970s, the idea was that it justified using some public resources because there were all kinds of genres of music and other kinds of programming that commercial radio simply would never do. And whether that was classical or jazz or show tunes or academic lectures or poetry readings, whatever it was, the idea was that college radio stations would evolve into more broadly public radio and provide these genres of programming that commercial radio wouldn't touch. Well, we've kind of lost that, and instead we've given over much of the public radio system to the news and talk produced by NPR. You wouldn't want to give that up. It's terrific programming, but I'm hopeful that what we'll find is that through new technologies, through the opening of these new channels with digital radio, that public radio will be able to go back to its original mission while also continuing with the high-quality news and talk programming.
Yeah, when I started, the programming on Wisconsin Public Radio was quite a bit different. We had, you know, you could literally have Hawaiian music followed by, a conversation with some professors, followed by, you know, whatever. And that certainly has changed, although we've certainly tried to keep our local roots.
Yeah, it's important, I think, for public radio, like commercial radio, to get back to those roots of sounding like the place that they represent. You know, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, that you could still drive across the country and, you know, not even look at the signs that told you what city you were in. You could just tune your radio and you would get a good sense of what place you were in. You would hear Zydeco in Louisiana. You'd hear the blues down south. We've kind of lost that, and that's very sad, I think, because national satellites have made it so much easier for national programming to take over. And I think radio needs to get back to that, because that's one thing that radio can still do that no one else does, which is to provide that local connection.
Yeah. Mark, it's a real pleasure talking with you. I appreciate it very much. I enjoyed your book a lot, and as I said, my students next semester will be reading it.
I appreciate that, and there's more about the book, and as I say, the audio clips that people can hear over at the website, which is markfisher.com.
And that's Mark with a C. I wanted to make that point. MarkFisher.
Terrific.
And speaking of Fisher, we're going to be talking about fishes and fishing coming up next year. Mark, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
Mark Fisher is author of Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation, published by Random House. And it was a real pleasure for me to be able to talk with him. And I hope you enjoyed it, too. And I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy what's coming up next. We're going to be talking with one of our regular guests, Gary Engberg of Mesa Mania, Wisconsin, outdoor photographer, columnist, and co-host of a Madison-based radio show, Outdoor Horizons. And he's with us to talk about fish and fishing stories. Maybe you've got some good stories you want to share, or maybe you just have some questions for him. Coming up next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.